Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. As regular listeners to this program know, we've been expanding our religious literacy this month, learning about meanings of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and then last week about engaged contemplative themes for each night of Hanukkah. And today, we find ourselves in the third week of Advent, the period coming before Christmas. Many Christians today may not realize that in earlier centuries, Advent was informally called the Little Lent, meaning that, like the 6 weeks prior to Easter, Advent was observed as a sober time of spiritual purification, of examination of conscience, of prayer and reflection, and of fasting or giving up meat and alcohol. This time of somber spiritual preparation was in contrast with the 12 days of Christmas, which began on Christmas and continue, which do begin on Christmas and continue until the Feast of the Epiphany in early January. It was during the 12 days of Christmas that all the celebrating took place and not before. That is when the festive decorations went up, the rich foods and socializing were enjoyed. I'm not sure how it all got flipped in our culture and much of Western Europe such that the season of Christmas feels like the few weeks preceding it and not at all like the 12 days following it. It no doubt has something to do with the commercialization, which is made to seemingly require weeks of focus on Christmas shopping. It's almost impossible to imagine foregoing the Christmas parties to return to a Lenten sense of what Advent is supposed to be about, although individuals do manage to intensify their spiritual practices during these 3+ weeks and perhaps fast and abstain. Of course, spiritual engagement is not merely about bringing your own self back into balance with our larger context. It also demands that you look beyond yourself and connect with the conditions of other people and the rest of the natural world. So let's take a moment this season of Advent for a reflective examination of our collective conscience about just three matters. First, the horrifying massacre at the Sandy Hook School in Connecticut has perhaps finally broken the inertia with which we as a nation had drifted into a way of life in which every year there are some 30,000 plus gun deaths and 300,000 gun-related assaults in the United States. Every 2 months, we lose more Americans to gun violence than we did in the 9/11 attacks. Bill Moyers has noted that in his lifetime alone, far more Americans have been casualties of domestic gunfire than have died in all our wars combined. Sadly, it seems that martyrs are often the catalyst, I would say, for societal and political changes that should have been made long ago. But we have let the slaughter go on and on. Why is that? In addition to the NRA's lobbying, of course. How could we have been on drift for so long about this continual carnage? A second matter in which we might well consider collective culpability is the horrendous level of child poverty in our country. This drags on and on, getting worse. 1 in 5 children in the United States was living in a family with an income below the official poverty level last year, marking a whole decade of increases in the levels of child poverty, worsened, of course, by the economic collapse of 2007 through 2009. The official U.S. government poverty threshold for a family of four last year, by the way, was an annual income of $23,000. The percentage of children living in families below that poverty level increased from an already shameful 15.6% in 2001 when Bush took office, up to 21.4% in 2011, according to a study by the Foundation for Child Development that came out only a few days ago. The author of that report, Kenneth Land, made this statement when it was released, quote, "The significant economic improvements families made in the 1990s have now all but disappeared. Economic insecurity is spreading widely across both middle-class and low-income families. Not only are we seeing growing numbers of children in poverty, but children in middle-class families are also losing ground," unquote. The United States tolerates the highest rate of child poverty in the developed world. Yet expenditures on children by our government at all levels, municipal, county, state, federal, on programs like health care, child nutrition, and education, fell last year and are slated to fall even more in the coming year. We need to get the 1990s tax rates restored for everyone making over $100,000 a year. Not let the Bush tax cuts for the rich stay in place for everyone making up to $400,000 a year, as President Obama now offers, and certainly not for incomes of up to $1 million a year, as the Republicans insist. Where is the public outcry on extending Bush's ill-conceived income tax cuts for the rich when 20% of American children are suffering every day and sinking lower? A third matter we might well take a hard look at during a season of reflection is the lack of serious action to slow the damage to our planet and its present and future generations that will be done and already has been done by human-caused global climate disruption. Where is the carbon tax? Does anyone ever dare mention it in Washington? That's merely one of many political and other actions that need to be taken, but where is the public demand? Wake up, folks. This is not a dress rehearsal. 25 years of environmentalist efforts to seriously reduce the causes of global climate disruption were repeatedly beaten back by the corporate sector and its hirelings in our government. Now we are in the crisis, and all we can do is try to limit the amount of damage that's coming. If we do not, the human suffering will be incalculable. As most of you know, the major grassroots organization mounting actions to address this greatest crisis of our time is 350.org. Yesterday, they sent out an email with a poignant, videotaped, very low-key fundraising message from their co-founder, the distinguished author Bill McKibben. He seems pretty tired because he recently returned from 350.org's Do the Math Tour of cities all across the United States. That's one of their several focuses for the coming year that you can see on their website, 350.org. Please go there and listen to Bill McKibben's tape. It's only 2.5 minutes long. And then donate some money for their work. Though, as Bill says, joining their actions worldwide is just as important. Apparently, someone needs to organize the public outcry, and these are the people doing it. On a shoestring budget. Help them to succeed. Rise up and be part of the solution. Amen. Well, let's move into our interview. My guest today, joining us from England, is Jonathan Porritt. He's a prominent writer, consultant, and commentator in the United Kingdom on sustainability and all things green. His first book, Seeing Green, The Politics of Ecology Explained, was published the same year as my own green book, Green Politics, and that was 1984. So we've been kindred thinkers and activists for quite a long time, and I've loosely tracked his work over the years, which, believe me, is quite impressive. He was the co-chair of the Green Party in the United Kingdom in the early 1980s, and he was co-author, along with Paul Ekins, of the influential Green Party of the UK platform in 1983. And that one went around the world as a model for Green parties and other activist groups. And then from 1984 to 1990, he was the director of Friends of the Earth in the UK. And in 1996, Jonathan Porritt co-founded with Sarah Parkin and Paul Ekins Forum for the Future, which is now the UK's leading nonprofit organization for sustainable development, with 70 staff members and over 100 partner organizations, including some of the world's leading companies. In addition, he's a longtime ecological advisor to Prince Charles and serves as co-director of the Prince of Wales Business and Sustainability Program. From 2000 to 2009, he served as chairman of the UK Sustainable Development Commission, providing high-level advice to government ministers. He's also a non-executive director of Wessex Water. Wow, Wessex, doesn't that make you feel you're in a Thomas Hardy novel? Egdon Heath, Rettleman. Because, as Hardy lovers know, he brought up the medieval name for that area, the Kingdom of Wessex, into his 19th century novels. Well, not to stray off track here. Last February, Jonathan Porritt was installed as the Chancellor of Keele University, also in Wessex. That's one of the universities that Britain founded in the years right after World War II. His latest books are Capitalism, As If the World Matters. There's a new edition of that in 2007. And then came Globalism and Regionalism. And then Living Within Our Means. And in the year 2000, he received from the Crown the honorary title CBE, which stands for Commander of the British Empire. Talk about your Thomas Hardy days. He received that honor for services furthering environmental protection. Jonathan Porritt, welcome to All Together Now.
Charlene, very nice to be here.
Well, I'd like to begin by hearing about what this government-organized commission, the UK Sustainable Development Commission, did during those 9 years. When you were the chair, because due to the depressing and dysfunctional state of our politics over here, it's all but impossible to imagine a federal-level advisory commission being established to guide the United States on sustainable development, especially to guide government policies. So, I mean, what did you do? What was the focus and the scope of that work?
You did once have a presidential commission on climate change, if I remember rightly, and I think that preceded the Sustainable Development Commission, in fact. But we were a new creation. Tony Blair was the Prime Minister at that time. He was very concerned not just about climate change, but about how to create different models of economic development. He knew the government didn't have an independent advisory body. He decided to create one, and I became the first chair of that body, and I have to take my hat off to our politicians then, because they really did set it up as a genuinely independent body. Of course, our money came from government. In the end, we had a staff, a professional secretariat of around 65 people as advisors to different government departments. But we were completely independent. We were appointed to be independent, and that was the expectation. And I can't say they liked everything that we advised them with, as it were. They didn't necessarily accept our advice all the time. But because this was seen to be a really useful mix in the whole policy-making process, I think that everybody saw it in a way as a model of really good governance in trying to get sustainability into the heart of government.
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing. I can barely hear you, so...
I'm speaking as close to the phone as I can.
No, I'm sure it's not your problem. It must be some problem in between New York and my phone from the PRN station. Well, I'm also interested. I looked online and saw several talks that you've given, and I was particularly taken by one that was titled Psychodynamics of Optimism in an Apocalyptic Age, which apparently has also been put into print form. So could you tell us about that? Because, again, you know, there's a lot that's happening now, but I'm beginning to understand why optimism is called a quality of the youth. It's not only that they have a lot of energy, but they're also lacking the long view of activists of all the struggles along the way that didn't carry the day. Here we are, and I get emails all the time, oh, there's a new book talking about how maybe Christianity and ecology should be brought together, and I thought, my gosh, this was written in the 1970s. Why is this happening at sort of an elementary level? On the other hand, you know, the awareness is spreading more broadly throughout the culture, but I listened to that tape, as much of it as was captured on YouTube. It was just two small bits, and it was very interesting. So could you tell us about that?
Certainly can. Actually, it's funny you should mention that, Charlene. I'm sitting here at my desk in my office in England, and I can see your book on the shelf about 5 yards away, States of Grace. So there you are when it comes to thinking about contributions on the spiritual dimension of sustainability and of green politics. It's something we've both been very interested in for a long time.
Yes.
I think that what I was trying to talk about there, which is really difficult today, is the fact that when you look really honestly at the state of the science about climate change, and you mentioned Bill McKibben and his astonishing work as an activist in the USA and globally, and Bill knows as well as anyone that the likelihood of maintaining a kind of stable climate now gets less and less every year. Every year we waste,
that's
the
right.
Likelihood of us stabilizing the climate diminishes. So there are more and more scientists every year who, when they are asked about this, will acknowledge, very reluctantly often, they will acknowledge that it is too late to hold emissions below that magic number which keeps the climate stable, and that we are now almost certainly into a runaway climate change world in the second half of this century. Now, there are many scientists who don't believe that. It's still something that is contested. It's still a big controversial debate, but it gets harder and harder to maintain one's sense of optimism against a backdrop where the science just takes us deeper and deeper into a very depressing analysis of the prospects for humankind. And I suppose what I was trying to point up there was the difference really between a somewhat facile optimism that abounds in the green movement, a lot of technology-driven pseudo-optimism that we can sort this out still, and genuine hopefulness, which is vested much more in a vision of humankind and transforming the human spirit rather than simply relying on a techno-fix to create an answer to our problems. And too much optimism goes with too much febrile enthusiasm about technology, and what we really need to do is to base our hopefulness in a deeper understanding of human nature.
Ah, the possibilities of human nature.
Well, indeed, and I'm sure, like you, I imagine that we're following the same kind of debates in this area, and I'm absolutely fascinated by the debate about whether or not human beings are kind of genetically predisposed to destroy their own prospects for a good life or even for survival, or whether in fact we're predisposed eventually in a muddled and painful way to work our way through to completely different patterns of collaboration, cooperation, symbiotic relationship with the natural world. And I'm, you know, I think the jury's out on this. I'm still reasonably hopeful that we will discover that our genetic inheritance, the evolution of our species, as it were, takes us towards that place of greater and greater cooperation rather than the sort of competition that some people point to.
No, I think you're absolutely right, because we come out of dynamic interrelatedness. You know, I mean, that these new discoveries that I was so fascinated with in relational reality, and this radio program continues to track, are coming up in all fields. And it's very clear that we do not have, until these recent discoveries in the past decade, a clear sense of our own nature as humans. You know, for instance, that study of elderly people that said people who are more socially connected have less of a decline in motor skills, gripping, walking.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are profoundly interrelated beings. And our physicality, the state of our physicality, depends on the quality of our relationships with other people and with the rest of the natural world, and there's so much new evidence of that.
Mm.
So I think those people who say, oh, it must be our genetic nature to do this, are ignorant of cultural history, because you can see, you know, we made a choice in the West at certain points to turn away from various indigenous and then long-lasting holistic perceptions of the life experience and, you know, go on to the mechanistic model that we're just operating on top of nature as an advanced industrialized society. And now there's a grand correction at hand, and that's what is exciting. And I don't think people who raise the pessimism flag for that reason have any ground to stand on. But it's quite difficult to see how to reverse the engines of the way things are set up with both business and government. And
I think that's, I think that's absolutely the right point. I don't think they have any solid intellectual ground to stand on from an evolutionary perspective, this kind of calling up of a sort of ineluctable evolutionary destiny for humankind, taking us to the edge of the abyss. There's no grounds for that. But where, of course, their skepticism and pessimism may be more firmly based is in the inability of our elites today, our political and business elites, to act in the interests of society more broadly and to start to understand that if society is, as you pointed out in your introduction today, Charlene, if society is permanently whittled away in terms of its entitlements and the basic decency of the lives that people can expect, then those same elites at the end of the day will also be the losers and not the winners as they are. So I think that the skepticism, pessimism, comes more from the short-term failure of political elites than from any deeper understanding of what human nature is about.
Right, I agree, but and then there's this developmental problem that's also quite worrisome, which is, for reasons that aren't entirely understood, there's a survey they do over here every year of young adults, and then they graph the results, and this one study showed that around the year 2000, empathy just sort of falls off a cliff. And people are not interested in the fact that one out of five children are living in poverty. And even an older person who doesn't have the excuse of perhaps that electronic immersion, I call it, that is so damaging to children in the formative years now, but the governor of, I think it was South Dakota, gave us his reason for not expanding the Medicaid coverage, medical aid for poor people in the state.
Yeah.
He said, you know, they're not children, they're not disabled, you know. In other words, they're poor of their own accord, and the hell with them. So this hyper-modern culture seems to contribute to a hardening of attitudes about even wanting to know about the condition of other people. And what arises in my mind quite often is what the Jesuit John Sobrino said when he was doing a lecture tour of the United States after his colleagues, the six Jesuits and the cook and her daughter who were murdered in El Salvador by the paramilitary squads in the 1980s. The only reason he wasn't murdered is because he was away on a lecture trip in Thailand. So then he went across the United States talking to people about what had happened, and he found a lot of people didn't want to hear about it. Oh, that's too political or whatever. And so he said, it's not a sin to not know about the suffering of other people, but it is a sin to not want to know. And I feel that that's more and more what we're drifting toward or we're into now. Do you see that in your country?
Yes. Yep. No, I do. I think one has to understand that, to be honest, Charlene. I think that the weight of everything that goes wrong in the world, the weight of suffering, the instantaneous media connection with that suffering is almost impossible for people to cope with. There isn't a day goes by before we, without us being exposed to an intensity of suffering that is actually incredibly difficult to deal with. And I'm sort of more sympathetic to the idea that people can't actually balance the demands of their own life with needing to respond empathetically to that level of suffering, which is constant and ubiquitous. And I think there's something going on that just means that the only way to cope with this instantaneous media barrage of mass suffering around the world is to close down a bit of one's own spirit about that. And actually, I'm sympathetic to that. And I can see why people do it. And I'm not too worried about that, because I think that's a coping mechanism, really, that we've lost our sense of agency and power here, because we are connected to suffering everywhere in the world all the time. Whereas in the past, you were connected to the suffering of people in your own community, your own village, your own household sometimes, the immediate environs that you lived in. And then it was manageable. There was something you could do. You may choose not to do it, but there was something you could do about it. And I'm not so gloomy as you are either on the modern culture, by the way. I think I don't think young people are as disconnected via the media that they use today from the rest of the world as you make out. I think for
no,
every story.
No, I wouldn't
story,
say they're disconnected. I say the electronic immersion has certain effects in their formative years.
Yes, but some of those effects are really good. This interconnectivity with the rest of the world is amazing. I mean, there is nothing to stop any young person anywhere in the world today being part of other young people's lives everywhere in the world.
That's
everywhere.
Right. And there's
a huge reference library
online. Yeah, you can learn
that
anything.
But not just reference libraries, living with them in terms of the
technology. No, I see the connectivity, and, you know, I also see the other side of it, the surveillance and the tracking. But I think this kind of, oh, there's too much suffering, so I can't do anything about it anyway, that then spills over into why 350.org and Bill McKibben have a hard time getting traction with issue and lots of other people, because they feel, oh, all the climate stuff, I can't do anything about that. It's just, it's kind of a learned passive response.
Yeah, no, I agree. So is Hurricane Sandy changing that for you?
Certainly in the New York area. People just say, what did it take to wake up? Oh, I see a hurricane had to hit Wall Street directly and flooded. And I think that picture, as soon as I saw that picture of Bloomberg Businessweek online about 3 days after Hurricane Sandy, then called Superstorm Sandy, by the time it hit land up north, But 3 days after it happened, and, you know, that was a cover with a red background and a photograph of the flooded streets of Manhattan and the big title over it saying, it's global warming, stupid.
Yeah.
And as soon as I saw that on Business Week, I thought, well, of course that's it. You know, I think Bloomberg must have heard from corporate leaders saying, this is going to cost us a lot of money, and we're not going down for those oil industry corporation guys. You know, this is really serious, and it's going to damage everyone. So I think there has been that kind of a shift.
Which is the great paradox, isn't it, of climate change, that it has to get incredibly painful and directly painful to people in positions of power and influence to persuade them to start making the changes that have to be made. And it's
not clear over here whether that's going to happen, but we can get back into that in a minute. We have to pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, and I'm speaking with my guest, Jonathan Porritt. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Jonathan Porritt, from England. His website is jonathanporritt.com. That's JonathanPorritt.com. And the website for his organization is forumforthefuture.org. I want to move into some of your other work, but before we leave this subject, that talk you gave on psychodynamics of optimism in an apocalyptic age, there was an interesting point you made about, you put it as a question, do we have a responsibility in this situation, in the planetary crisis, to be optimistic? Which I think is a very interesting way to approach it. There's a difference between hope, which is married with hard work, needs to be, as opposed to blind faith, or some Pollyanna sense that things are moving forward. So maybe you can say something about our responsibility for optimism. And then the last thing on that talk, you mentioned a report that wasn't covered very much in the United States by Kofi Annan, Anatomy of a Silent Crisis, and I wonder if you could tell us about that.
So the responsibility story is really interesting, and I took a lot with activists and how they maintain their own sense of personal engagement, how they can keep the energy levels going. It's a as you'll know, Charlene, and many of the people you've talked to, it's a tough world being an activist. You have to maintain that kind of constant passion about what it is that's happening, and it's very difficult to do it if in the back of your mind you actually think it is, quotes, too late, quotes, because then the dynamics change. Then the dynamics are all about persuading people to prepare themselves for something which is going to be so horrifically painful that the only difference will be whether you're well prepared or ill prepared. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a real story here that we have still got a window of time, as I see it, to persuade people to start making these changes, because actually a sustainable world is a better world. It's a more creative, compassionate, brilliant, economically sound world than the world we have today. And whilst we've got that opportunity, and it may not last for much longer, but for as long as it lasts, our responsibility is to point people towards the fact that what we call sustainability actually equals, in most people's minds, as it were, just better. Better for us, for our families, for the natural mm-hmm. world, for future generations, better in terms of food, energy, work, all the rest of it. If we can just keep on telling people, forget the rubric about sustainability, forget all that stuff, just think about what would a good world look like, because sure as hell it would look a lot better than the world we're living in today. And that's what I mean by the responsibility. We have to drive this sense. We've still got a chance to do it for the upside reasons, but actually we're talking about a better world, not avoiding a worse world, as it were.
It reminds me a little bit of what work that Bill McDonough and Michael Brongard do with design. You know,
Absolutely.
We're not interested in just doing less
Absolutely.
Damage. We want to make things better, the human interaction with the rest of the world, smarter. And so it restores instead of does less damage. Speaking of that, let's move into this big project you started. The organization started in the mid-1990s, Forum for the Future.
Mm.
And that has a number of programs and page after page of interesting products on the website people can look at, forumforthefuture.org. How can you tell us about the trajectory of that organization over time?
I can. I certainly can. I mean, funnily enough, it's a story that emerges from my own sense in 1992 when I went to the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro and came away from that thinking there's a lot of positive energy here. If we just go on beating out the same old story about how awful this all is and pointing to people's failings and doing what I call the guilt, fear, and anger trip, you know, guilt at the fact we are not behaving responsibly, fear at the fact that the apocalypse is bearing down on us, and anger at the perceived responsibility of others who are failing us, then if that's all we've got to call on in terms of our emotional repertoire, we're in terrible trouble, because that's not how people's minds work. They work much more to the positive. They work to the affirmation of what's good in their own lives and what they see as being good in the people they respect and love. And so really the forum grew out of this sense that if we could find ways of harnessing that positive energy, it's not to deny the importance of reminding people of the negative things happening. It's just to say, this is going to work better. It'll work better because more people will come with us on the journey. And so that's what we started.
Well, I think that also came out, though, of your earlier work with the Green Movement. It has always had a positive green vision, an eco-social vision, and it seems like you really found a way to put this into the society.
Yeah. No, I've tried for a long time to do that. I couldn't make it work at Friends of the Earth. Friends of the Earth is still an organization that I'm passionate about, but its principal modus operandi was basically stopping people doing bad things, and that's what it's very good at. And I felt I needed to try something along the line about helping people do good things, and that's really what the forum is trying to do.
Uh-huh.
And that means working with lots of people in different sectors, but particularly, and this is where the controversy creeps in, particularly working with people in the private sector and some of the world's largest multinational companies to reinforce the good, positive things that happen in those companies, instead of being part of the wonderfully dynamic brigade of people who are happy to beat up on multinational companies. Funnily enough, we need both. We need people to go on biting the ankles of big multinational companies, because those ankles still need biting. But we also need people who can encourage and persuade and advocate even better
this way forward.
Inside.
In this country, several years ago, someone, a very highly educated, sophisticated family friend of ours in New York, was after Gore's climate change film was shown in a lot of churches around the country and made a big impact. And but then the Republicans were beating up on it, and you know, I mean, for a while, even Fox was behind paying attention to global warming. It was quite remarkable in 2006. And then there was that circling of the wagons and saying, "Oh, this is just Gore's pet project." And this person, family friend of ours, said, "Well, if Gore isn't the right person, who would the right person be in this country?" And I was so amazed. I said, one person? You know, in Germany and so many of the greener countries in Europe, they have all the sectors working on this. You know,
absolutely.
Redesign the trains to use less energy, redesign the university buildings, the public and the private sector. It's like everybody jumping in to solve the problem. So I see you as, you know, furthering part of that bigger way we can go into this new vision.
Yes, and it's fascinating, Charlene, because give people a chance to play their part in making a better future. Honestly, I know very few people who spurn that chance. If you approach them on their own terms and you just say, we know we got to do something about this, it's not too late. You still have a fantastically important role to play here, whether it's at the community level, at your church level, whether it's in your company, your community group, it doesn't really matter. There's still a chance to make such a difference in people's lives. And without being corny about it, it is true that people respond to an invitation to celebrate what is good about them and what is good about the communities they live in. And we've been so bad at doing this in the environment movement. I'm sorry, I don't want to make this too much of a retrospective on why environmentalism hasn't worked terribly well. But we haven't really cracked the art of engaging with people in their lives and in the places that they're passionate about. And I think we've paid a heavy price for that, really. So we're doing a bit of counterbalancing now, and it's exciting because whilst we've got time, we can make this positive energy work.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened over here in that dynamic, I mean, I think you may be right with some environmental groups, but the Green Party always had the positive vision, had
Absolutely.
The eco-social analysis and the eco-social
yep.
vision, but we weren't getting much traction. I would go lecturing about community-based economics, regional trade, and people would always say, yes, but where is this already working? And then the farmers market movement as part of the food movement happened. And that was when people got it instantly about building up local economic networks. So it turned out that food was the catalyst, which we just didn't guess. But anyway, it's a lot farther along now with this whole idea of building food security around a community with a green belt of farms so your food doesn't have to come vast distances. So definitely,
and
there's
a lot of progress now,
and it's moved out from smaller circles into the larger public.
Absolutely, and you've got some brilliant stories about that in the States. I mean, we really, over here in Europe, we really celebrate this whole community-supported agriculture story in the U.S. It is immensely powerful.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, I notice you still are running the master's program that Sarah Parkin worked out in the first 10 years in Forum for the Future, and I wish you would tell people a little bit about that because it's such an interesting model, how you place these students. They have their baccalaureate degree. They're earning a master's degree through a university in England that's associated with, that Forum of the Future has affiliated with for this program. And what do they do during those 10 months? They're placed in different sectors. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, no, it has been actually one of the most amazing things we've done. And I'm not being too partisan here because I think people recognize that this master's course has kind of cracked the mold a bit, because what we do is just take 12 students. We wish it could be more, Charlene, but it costs a bit of money, obviously, to do this stuff.
Uh-huh.
We take 12 postgrads, and instead of just doing another kind of master's course, we do this work-based learning approach. And so they have secondments into different organizations. And so historically what we've done, we send them for a month to a leading company, a municipality, to work with an NGO, to work with a media group, to work with professional organizations. You know, we just mix and match the whole portfolio of experience so that instead of thinking sustainable development equals this one perspective, they come out saying this is complicated. Sustainable development means many different things to many different people.
Mm-hmm.
It has a common heartland across all of those different sectors. But we need to understand these different sectoral perspectives to really make progress in our own lives as sustainability activists. And over the 12 years, it has been brilliant watching those young kids. And we are so excited about what they go out to do in the world because they go with a really well-balanced understanding, but still with a radicalism. That's the thing. They're not intolerant about the fact that a business might be very keen on sustainability. They don't, you know, they're no longer going to curl their lip at the fact that if you're doing sustainable development in a municipality, that it's going to be, some of it's going to be pretty boring. Making better lives for people isn't always dramatic frontline stuff. It's often getting the basics right.
Mm-hmm.
So they come away from this experience understanding that this is applied, it's about inclusivity, it's about understanding diversity in the movement, and they're just great kids, to be honest. They're just amazing. So we've had a lot of fun with that course.
Well, I think it's really a brilliant structure, and I would love to see it replicated in this country. So I'm urging listeners who have any connection with education or know someone who does, take a look at forumforthefuture.org and the master's program, and then there's something you can click on. It says if you want more information about how this master's program works that Jonathan just described, because I really think it could be replicated to great effect everywhere in the world. Well, we have just about a minute left, but I think it's so interesting that you're now the chancellor of a university. What are your plans for that?
Well, I'm not sure what the equivalent post would be in the U.S. It's not an executive position. It sort of comes with a lot of wearing robes and handing out degrees and lots of ceremonial stuff. But I did say to the university that I wasn't really interested in the ceremonial. I was interested in working with the university to make Kiel the most sustainable university in the world. I mean, that's what our ambition is, and I'm really excited at this. It's a brilliant university. It's doing wonderful stuff already, but the prospect of trying to sort of take it on in such a way that it meets all of those different challenges, educationally, as well as in terms of the curriculum, the community, the campus, all the rest of it, is just such a brilliant thing to think the university is the place where young people, just as a matter of course, pick up the values and the practice of living sustainably. That's
right. That's
something I'm excited by.
Yeah. And that's exactly, I think, the vision that all the universities need to aim for. It's not only greening the physical plant, but ecologizing the curriculum across the disciplines and bringing ecological wisdom into all of the subjects, our way of thinking about things. Well,
exactly.
That's all the time we have, but I want to thank you so much, Jonathan Porritt, for coming on the program.
It's been my pleasure and privilege to connect with you, Charlene. You're one of my great heroes out there. You've been doing an amazing work for so long, so spending a bit of time with you like this has been delightful.
Oh, thank you, Jonathan. Well, let's amble over to the Arts Corner. Ah, yes, it's Christmas time in the Arts Corner, so we have an appropriate poem. Now, in 1530, Martin Luther, as I'm sure you know, delivered his famous sermon on the afternoon of Christmas Day. And in that sermon, he exhorted the faithful to accept the child and his birth and forget the mother as far as this is possible, although her part cannot be forgotten, for where there is a birth, there must also be a mother, unquote. After all, Luther pointed out, the angel who appeared to the shepherds at the time of the Nativity announced that the Savior had been born not to Mary, but to all people. Quote, I bring unto you glad tidings of great joy, for unto you is born this day the Savior, he cited from Scripture. Well, that's one way to look at it, but it's not the only way. So today we have a poem by another member of the Protestant clergy, and an Episcopalian priest. Her name is Reverend Alla Renee Bozarth, B-O-Z-A-R-T-H. Her poem is about the Virgin Mary. This is a prayer she wrote as the prefatory in a worship service in 2001. Before Jesus was his mother, before supper in the upper room, breakfast in the barn, before the Passover feast, a feeding trough, and here the altar of earth, fair linens of hay and seed, before his cry, her cry, before his sweat of blood, her bleeding and tears, before his offering, hers, before the breaking of bread and death, the breaking of her body in birth, before the offering of the cup, the offering of her breast, before his blood, her blood, and by her body and blood alone, his body and blood and whole human being, the wise one knelt to hear the woman's word in wonder, holding up her sacred child, her God in the form of a babe, she said, receive and let your hearts be filled and your lives be filled with love, for this is my body, this is my blood. For our song this week, how about something from Handel's Messiah? This recording was made in 2006 with the London Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Sir Colin Davis, along with the Tenebrae Choir. Rest assured, dear listeners, that even though I actually do remember the alto parts for almost all of the Messiah from high school choir, I promise not to sing along. Here is, "For Unto Us a Child Is Born." That was "For Unto Us a Child Is Born" from Handel's Messiah, 1741. Merry Christmas, one and all, and happy solstice, too. And I trust you've heard by now that the Mayan calendar does not say the world is going to end tomorrow, so just relax. It merely says one era of time is ending and another beginning, according to the way they reckoned time. Well, in case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week for our New Year's Eve-ish program, when the biodiversity expert and deeply green thinker Peter Warshall will help me think through some big issues at year's end. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.